Hey guys, it's James Chester here. You're listening to the Gather Round the Lamp podcast by underagaslitlamp.com.
Gather Round the Lamp, an Aston Villa podcast.
Aimed in towards Archer! That's a fabulous header!
Once again, the Tigers banish the flick on. Oh, brilliantly done! Magnificent from Danny Ings!
He's going to have to go on his own here, and he's perfectly happy to do that! Sensational goal!
Ramsey!
That's a big clap, mate. So.
Gather Round Villains and welcome back to Gather Round the Lamp, an Aston Villa podcast brought to you by underagaslitlamp.com. Another weekend and another Aston Villa victory. It's all getting a bit boring now, isn't it? So we're here to try and liven things up a bit for you and look ahead to the visit of Newcastle also on Saturday. I'm your host, Andy, and this week, a warm welcome back to Craig.
Hi, Andy. Hi, listener. Isn't this a beautiful, beautiful time? What a time to be alive as an Aston Villa fan. It's like it's 1999.
All over again.
Almost.
What was happening in 1999?
I think we were top of the league for until Christmas,
yeah,
weren't we?
Yeah.
I think that was 99 or 2000. It was somewhere around there, around that time period. Yeah. We were flying.
Made up entirely of Englishmen, except for Bosnic, wasn't it?
Yeah, but there was one. I think that actually is the last team comprised entirely of Englishmen because we had Oakes in goal for one of the games.
Yes.
So I've seen that.
Michael Oakes.
Yeah. We had Oakes in goal for one of the games, and that was the last ever. I think Steve Stone was in there. Bit of a throwback. See if I can find the 11 while we're talking about other things.
Steve Stone is currently a Premier League coach.
Oh,
do you know who for?
Is he Forest? Isn't it Stone and Wone back at Forest? Have I made that up?
No, it is Stone and Wone, but it's under Dyche at Everton.
Ah, there you go.
They were all at Burnley together. So, yes, I saw him briefly on the telly on Match of the Day yesterday. So I thought, oh, that's Steve Stone.
Stone and Wone were that Nottingham Forest team was very good. Brian Roy, Stan Collymore, obviously Stuart Pearce. Pretty good. All right, I have it for you here, listener. The last ever starting 11 was on the 27th of February, 1999. Last ever starting 11 that was all English in the Premier League. We lost, unfortunately, against Coventry City. In goal was Michael Oakes. Right back was Steve Watson. Centre-halves were Ricky Skomeka and Gareth Southgate, whatever happened to him. Left back was Alan Wright. Left midfield was Lee Hendry. Central midfield pairing for Aston Villa, Simon Grayson and Ian Taylor. Simon Grayson, dear oh dear. Paul Merson was there as a kind of free roll, I guess. And then up front, we had Julian Joachim and Dion Dublin. That was the last ever English, fully English. Last ever one.
That's incredible. But we've digressed early here, Craig.
We have digressed early. We haven't even started. There is an honourable mention to a Fulham team in 2006, but they had a Scottish midfielder, but it was an all British 11. I won't go through them because, you know, it's not Aston Villa based.
Yeah, no, that's good. Good stuff. Good bit of history there, and good times. And we are going through the good times again, but we're just going to touch on a breaking news story, which involves. Really, the people that were at the helm the last time Aston Villa were going through a similar sort of run of wins, or certainly good results, and that was Dean Smith, former manager, and of course John Terry, who was his assistant, and Shakespeare joined shortly after that once we were promoted. But obviously the news has come out this evening that those three are going to be taking over at Leicester City until the end of the season, at least. It's quite a big story, really. Obviously, Leicester have knocked on the door of a few potential managers, Jesse Marsh being one. I think Martin O'Neill was mentioned last week as well. What do you think of this one, Craig? Do you think this is a good move for them? Do you think it'll work for Leicester?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, you know, welcome back to the Premier League for Dean Smith. I was really sceptical at the time of him jumping straight into that Norwich job. Norwich, as we know, they never invest. They come up to go back down and it doesn't look like they're coming back up again. And I didn't think that he had a cat's chance in hell of saving Norwich, and that proved to be the case. And unfortunately, he was fired from there earlier this season. Now, Dean Smith has already provided a great escape for Aston Villa. He kept us up when we were, I think, we were 7 points adrift with 4 games to go or something mad like that.
Yeah, we were.
So, and Leicester are not in anywhere near as dire straits, and a bit like the Aston Villa side at that time. He's got a couple of standout performers there. He's got James Maddison. He's got Iheanacho. I think Vardy's past is sell by date, unfortunately for him. We saw the quality that the young Shire horse Harvey Barnes has. So there's some real talent in that team. So to get the band back together, it was really strange. I think John Terry, when he resigned from Aston Villa, you know, a couple of weeks before the season, very turbulent time that was for Aston Villa, with Grealish leaving, O'Kelly leaving, Terry leaving. Terry obviously maybe had some delusions of grandeur that he was going to jump into the hot seat somewhere. That hasn't quite worked out for him, so probably a good opportunity for John Terry as well. And I wish the three of them all the best. Obviously, Dean Smith, I know you're not a big Craig Shakespeare fan, but Dean Smith is certainly remains a hero to me, and I want to see Dean Smith succeed. We've already played Leicester now twice, so it's no business of mine, really. But in terms of Dean Smith, I would be delighted if he can turn it around and if he can keep Leicester in the league. And this could be, you know, it's a big risk for Dean Smith because Leicester are really struggling at the moment. But this could be his kind of last chance saloon in the Premier League, Andy.
I think it is. I'm quite surprised in a way that he's got another Premier League job, because the Norwich job, I think, was so damaging for him. But undoubtedly, he has pedigree at Premier League level, and certainly from the position that Leicester find themselves in. In fact, Villa are in a lot worse position, with a lot worse squad as well, I would venture. So it's a great opportunity for him. It's no lose, really, because if they get relegated, well, he can hardly be blamed for that, and he'll move on and he'll be in the same position, probably looking in the Championship or lower for a job. And if it succeeds, he might get an opportunity with them next season, I guess, with his team, his backroom team there. The big one for me is John Terry. I think as Villa fans, we can all attest to the fact that when he walked into the building as a player and Steve Bruce, the standards massively increased very, very quickly. And they remained there pretty much until he left, and then things slipped again a little bit. I think someone like him demands absolute professionalism and 100% commitment all the time, and he certainly got that for the most part when he was at Villa. And I think it's a big thing for Dean Smith that John Terry's jumped back on board with him, because clearly they had a great working relationship. John Terry thinks the world of Dean Smith, and I think he will his presence in that Leicester dressing room will sharpen the minds double quick.
Yeah, and I think that the Leicester have been, you know, the Leicester City goal giveaway club in the last few weeks has been an interesting sight to behold for a neutral to their exploits. And if they can recreate the kind of siege mentality they did for us in Project Restart, keep it really tight at the back, in Iheanacho, Vardy, and not Iheanacho, Vardy's finished. In Iheanacho, who is the menace of Aston Villa, the scourge of Aston Villa, in James Maddison, and also in Harvey Barnes, just those three, you have enough talent there to really hurt most any Premier League team. So it might be enough for them, but they may have tried to close the door here a little bit after the after the horse has bolted, Andy, because you know, we've seen a lot of managerial changes. I think that Unai Emery is now the ninth longest serving manager in the league, or something crazy like that. So we'll see. But I wish them all the very best, and up the Dino.
Yeah, and the one weapon, of course, he doesn't have, which Dan would be saying, is he won't have Trezeguet.
He won't have Trezeguet at the back post, but.
Or of course, and the only reason we stayed up was because Hawkeye failed as well, remember? So, you know, it's never mind coming back from 7 points behind with four games to go. But, yeah, you know, there we are. But that's Leicester City anyway. We just thought we'd touch on that because obviously it's our boy, isn't it? It's our Dino, and we wish him all the best, and let's hope he does his career no end of good there. So good luck to him. But onto Aston Villa matters. We've moved forward massively, as we say, and we were visited by Nottingham Forest, who are also in that relegation fight at the other end of the table. Following on from two excellent wins at Chelsea and Leicester, the team remained the same, and the bench, I believe. Maybe some slight system changes with Bailey and Buendia sort of seeming to operate more in the wide areas. Of course, there was then that early injury to Leon Bailey in the first half. He'd made a really incisive run down the right and set up a chance for Watkins, and he looked like he's gone off with a hamstring injury there, which is incredibly disappointing for him. We thought maybe his injury worries were a thing of the past, the thing of last season, really. But he looks like he's going to perhaps miss a few games. And with Coutinho also out, are you at all concerned about the sort of the rather thin attacking options that Emery has available now?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that we had there was a moment on Saturday when we were toiling a little bit against Nottingham Forest, and I kind of pulled up the subs bench on my phone just to refresh my memory, and I was like, well, there's not a lot here really. There's to change it in the forward areas after, as you say, Bailey had gone off with his gingerbread injury. Unfortunately, there was only really John Duran to change things. And while John Duran, I think, is a player of enormous potential that we all consider, having a Coutinho out there or having a couple of other options certainly wouldn't have done any harm. Now, I suppose the good news is, in terms of the squad, that we are due to welcome Coutinho and Cash and Kamara back in the next week or two. But if that Newcastle fixture arrives before those three players are fit, then to quote Harry Redknapp, we are down to the bare bones.
Yeah, it seems like that, doesn't it? I know Emery did name check Caden Young, didn't he, in the press conference before the Forest game, as being someone they'd had to draft in almost to fill a position that they were looking to strengthen. And then, of course, Bertrand Traoré had decided to come back, and we'll talk about him in a few minutes. But I wonder whether that might be an opportunity for him to rejoin, or if there's another player that's impressing, you know, in the age groups, then maybe. Maybe this presents an opportunity for a week or two for someone like that to kind of come in and be that option on that side. But as kind of disappointing perhaps as Bailey's form has been, I think we're going to miss him, Craig.
Yeah, just as an option, I think that he's been effective in his cameos as a substitute. I think he actually did really well in the Chelsea game when he came on, because he provided, while he didn't necessarily contribute massively towards the result in the end, what he did was he occupied the defenders and he gave them something else to worry about, because you can't press so high when you have Leon Bailey on the field if you're Chelsea, because you know that he can exploit you in behind. And he had a couple of jinky runs, and I do think he has major value for Aston Villa moving forward next season as an impact sub. I think that is the kind of player coming off the bench that can really benefit you. So we haven't heard the extent of the injury as of yet, but you'd imagine with a hamstring pull, it's always at least kind of 3 to 4 weeks. So yeah, he will definitely be missed. Caden Young, as you say, has a lot of speed, a very young player. We have seen a little bit of him here or there. He was involved, obviously, in our fixtures actually against Chelsea, I think, in the mini pre-season post the World Cup, and did quite well. And Emery has shown a liking to him. Obviously, the problem that we have is that it's a double-edged sword, really. The benefit that we have is we have some wonderful prospects on loan in the Championship who are doing very, very well. The other side of that sword is we cannot recall them at this moment in time in the season, because it would be really useful to have a Philogene, a Bidace. It would be really useful to have an Aaron Ramsey to call upon just to boost the numbers. But we don't. So I would imagine for Newcastle, and we'll probably talk about this a bit later on, but while we're here, Andy, I'd imagine the safest thing to do would be what Emery did, I think, towards the end of the last game against Nottingham Forest, to bring Dendonka in to partner Douglas Luiz, move McGinn into the right midfield position, and move Buendia up front with Ollie Watkins. I would think that's the strongest 11. But then you do have, then again, a lack of options on the bench. It's going to be Traore and Duran, and that's kind of it.
Yeah, I think certainly I can see the lineup being slightly less attacking than slightly more pragmatic maybe against Newcastle anyway, and whether there'd have been a bit of a shift around. But you know, obviously good to have Bailey as an option at any stage, really, because he can be explosive. We've seen how he can affect games, certainly late on, with his pace and his skill and his finishing. So yeah, we'll have to see. But I mean, we'll like you say, we'll discuss the Newcastle game in a bit. But I think there are options there, just not very many, and not very many where you can, like you say, if you're struggling in the game, kind of bring someone on to affect something. So, you know, hopefully, like you say, those three you mentioned, particularly Coutinho, will be available at some stage soon, and we can use them, because we've got, you know, obviously these last few games have become very important all of a sudden. You know, so we'll see how
from
that goes.
Kind of smoking cigars without and walking along the beach, you know, strolling. we're now in the thick of a European fight with some really big dogs, and Chelsea, obviously, with Frank Lampard. That's an interesting appointment. Liverpool looked reborn yesterday in their match against Arsenal after going 2-0 down. That's the best Liverpool have looked in a long time. We still have Brentford in the mix. We still have Brighton in the mix, who were absolutely robbed the other day. Tottenham are there as well, and not to mention Newcastle. So we are in amongst the some of the bigger hitters for these European places.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, I think I did actually mention being on the beach a few weeks ago after we lost to Arsenal. So, you know.
Yes.
I think we've done a Denmark.
Which was probably harsh in retrospect.
we've done a Denmark and got off the beach and started competing again. So that's a reference to the 92 Euros. I'm not sure if for any younger listeners.
Slightly before my time there. Slightly before my time. I mean,
do you know the story? The story was that they didn't qualify for the 92 Euros. Yugoslavia did, but Yugoslavia were told that they couldn't compete because of the situation in their country at the time. So Denmark were drafted in at the last minute, and the story was they came off the beach to win the tournament, which they did. So yeah, quite an interesting one. Always worth looking back on those kind of stories. But yeah, Villa legend Peter Schmeichel.
The only thing I know about that team is Schmeichel and Michael Laudrup.
Yeah,
and I think Brian Laudrup. I think that's about the depth of my 1992 Denmark knowledge.
And I think Kent Nielsen, who was a Villa player, who perhaps left by then, but he was certainly at Villa one or two years before that, and he was in that team. So it was certainly an interesting one. But they called off the beach and won it, and that's how it feels for Villa at the moment. But just looking at the game, it was the first half was relatively uneventful. I think Craig, there was a early chance for Watkins. He was kind of put in by a bit of an error, and the ball bounced to him, and he drilled it wide. But Villa maintained this kind of patient approach, really. Thought the midfield worked really hard to kind of keep control of the game and really limit Forest's any... I mean, I'm not sure Forest came with a very ambitious approach anyway, but we certainly kept them contained. Moreno was probably the main outlet on the left with his pace, really getting forward well. It's easy in hindsight after the win, but how do you feel when you're watching Villa kind of go about their business at the moment with this kind of slow, patient style when we're not really getting at teams very much?
I think that it was really credit to Nottingham Forest and Steve Cooper. I think they made it really hard for Villa the other day, and I also still think there was a bit of legginess in the legs. What a phrase that is! Some legginess in the legs. Where else would it be? There was some fatigue in the legs from the Chelsea and the Leicester games. We still didn't look 100% fresh, and I think some of that's down to us not playing Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday, and part of that's down to the small squad. Not a lot of people Douglas Luiz, for example, has not had an opportunity to have a breather for some period of time. The Moreno-Dinia switch has been missing in the last couple of games as well. Obviously, there's no real understudy for Ashley Young, and he is at an age where three games in a week is probably a little bit challenging for him. So I thought Villa were a little bit tired, and I thought that as most people have observed, Andy, Forest came for a point. They I wouldn't say they parked the bus, but there was not a great deal of ambition in their play, which is understandable. A point for them would have been a good result. They've got an absolutely appalling away record. Cooper's clinging on to his job by a thread. So coming to Villa Park, one of the form teams in the Premier League, and setting up for a point is not an outrageous thing. But I just think we were lacking that little bit of guile. Buendia's radar was way off. And ironically, we mentioned Coutinho earlier. I think this was a game for Coutinho, a game where we've got most of the ball, a game where you need someone to really find those little gaps, find those half spaces and just create something magical. I think, I wouldn't say Villa were toiling, but I think we were certainly struggling to create clear opportunities against that five-man Forest defence and the three-man midfield in front of it. There just wasn't a great deal of room. So I wouldn't say I was frustrated. It was almost, I took it as a compliment that we are taken seriously now, that people feel they need to come to Villa Park and park the bus a little bit. And in the first half, that was kind of my feeling. I was like, we're probing, we're not looking too dangerous. But because we've been so lethal in front of goal, I always fancied us to score, Andy. I mean, what was it like in the halt?
Yeah, I think it's starting to sink in now. And I think obviously winning changes things, doesn't it? If you're winning, I think people are more patient, they're more understanding of the process and what's happening on the field. It's just that kind of, I guess, that complete lack of urgency, which is, you could say it's a lack of urgency, but it's ultimately a really deep belief in the idea that they will get their opportunity and they will take their opportunity, and that's a really great thing to have for a team, particularly so early into its development, I think. And the idea that we just, like you say, probing a little bit, trying a few things out, a few balls were going awry. You mentioned Buendia. I think Jacob Ramsey was guilty of that throughout the game, really. Trying things here and there, switching the play, just trying to draw Forest out a little bit, but not panicking, not getting too worried, not being affected by the crowd that maybe get a bit you know, come on, you know, they want to see some action, they want to see goals and chances and things like that. So, but I think generally that the crowd were pretty patient with them, backed them. You know, there was a good, reasonably good atmosphere in the ground. Obviously, people are very happy with how things are going. And I was just really impressed with that kind of that way of just kind of, as we've seen it in all the games, really, just taking their time, not rushing things, not panicking, you know, not getting over urgent, and you know, I quite enjoyed it in the sunshine at Villa Park, Craig.
Well, you and a couple of our podcast friends may have had some warm up beverages before the game, and I imagine you were feeling pretty froggy by the time 3 o'clock emerged. And an afternoon in the sun watching Villa pass a team to death, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I have to say that's the other thing with the passing them to death. I thought this in the Bournemouth game, and it was a similar thing here. When we're passing a team to death like this and they're doing shuttle runs back and forth, back and forth, and back and forth, I think towards the end of the Bournemouth game, if that game had got another 10 minutes, I think Villa would have scored another 2 or 3 goals. Their legs are completely gone, had Bournemouth's. And it was very similar towards the end of this game with the second goal. They were all at sea by that point, Nottingham Forest, because they'd been chasing shadows for 90 minutes. So there is also a feeling that when teams, and we've seen this happen to Villa, you know, at Man City last season springs to mind, when there was a late collapse, there is an element of just passing a team literally to death. You get them blowing through their backsides, as it were, and then in the last kind of 15-20 minutes, that's when you really apply the pressure, because you have that freshness of resting in possession, I think is the kind of tactical parlance for that. And you're fresh while the other guys are blowing. And with players like Jonjo Shelvey, who, with the best will in the world, is not the most dynamic individual, not someone who you'd look at and see a prime athlete or a running machine. With players like that in the opposition, you do have an opportunity to do that. And I think that was also the thing that was in the back of my mind in that first half, is even if they keep it like this, the last 15, 20, the legs are going to go and there's going to be spaces and chances for our forwards.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the thing that killed them straight away was right at the start of the second half and the first Villa goal, and it was you know, a really good ball from Ashley Young to pick out Traore, and it was his this trademark kind of outside of the left boot cross, which we saw quite a bit really in his first season with us. It obviously wasn't dealt with at all well by Forrest, and the ball fell to Shelvey, who essentially just passed it back to Traore, who'd followed his cross into the box, and he just decisively dispatched it past Navas in goal into the bottom corner. Really nice goal, really really well taken. Good moment for Traore after his worldie at Leicester a few days ago. The last time Traore scored at Villa Park, there were only sort of 10,000 in attendance as the COVID restrictions had just started to be lifted. And he's effectively won the team 6 points in the last week. So, you know, it's almost like he's just come in and picked up where he left off a couple of years ago, if we don't count the Gerrard season.
Yeah, I think that this is Bertrand Traore. I think that apologies if I just break my arm here, patting myself on the back. But when we were talking about signing some, you know, Dan Juma or some other people who were mooted in January, I had said on this very show that I did not believe this to be a prudent strategy. That the best thing to do would be to recall one or two of our existing players that we have on our books already, and use them until the end of the season, with someone like Bertrand Traore in particular, because, again, at the risk of belaboring the point here, his numbers, I'm not going to say it again after this, I promise, his numbers are better than Coutinho's, they're better than Buendia's, and they're better than Leon Bailey's across his Villa career. So when you have someone like this, you can somewhat depend on him to deliver goals. Now he scored two in two go- two games, well, less than two games, because he hasn't started. I don't, you know, he probably hasn't played 90 minutes in those two games combined. So while, yes, there are imperfections with Bertrand Traoré, I do not pretend that there aren't, this is someone who has always delivered for Aston Villa goals and assists when he's on the football pitch. And that is just an indisputable fact. However you feel about him is really irrelevant. Those are the facts. So when you have someone like this available, when you have someone like this in the squad, he is dependable. And I know he's not seen as dependable because he's such an artisan, but his numbers are dependable. You can depend on him to deliver goals and assists if he plays minutes of football. You can't necessarily depend on him to do other things, but you can depend on him for those things.
Yeah, he'd had kind of a wild swing at a chance in the first half, hadn't he, and put it over the bar. I thought it was quite a difficult chance. It was kind of rising and not an easy one to get over. But I agree. I think he's absolutely been as reliable as anyone, probably aside from El Ghazi, in terms of those kind of wide attacking positions since we came back into the Premier League. So, you know, and I think the fans really like him, but I can't decide whether he's still seen as a bit of a novelty, or whether they actually like him because they think he's a really good player and someone that can be effective. If there's any debate, I think it should now be the latter, because, you know, like you say, you know, he's barely played since he came back, and he's already won us 6 points. So, you know, that's effectiveness personified, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and that's not hyperbolic or any kind of stretch. It's the absolute fact. He scored the winner against Leicester, and he scored the winner against Nottingham Forest. That's 6 Premier League points in the bank from Bertrand Traoré, which is probably 6 more Premier League points than we've got from Philip Coutinho goals this season, with all due respect. So that's kind of where we are. He does deserve, as I've said, a great deal more respect. And also, he's ours. He's our player. He's an Aston Villa player, and we should support him as such. And we can enjoy him now for the rest of the season. Is he going to be at Villa for another five years? I would doubt it. But while he's here, let's enjoy his wizardry. Let's enjoy his magical moments. And also, the players seem to really enjoy him. You know, you can tell there's a real warmth around him, and that he's clearly a good egg and is appreciated amongst the dressing room. So I think that now we can start to hopefully appreciate him as well.
Yeah, and I love the way Emery talks about him as well. He says that, you know, he was obviously aware of him in France at Lyon. You know, was impressed with him there. Impressed with him in his first season at Aston Villa, and a player that you can imagine them him walking into Bodymore Heath at some point last December time, and Traoré's there, kind of in the gym, you know, working on his injury, and Emery kind of looking at him thinking, what's he doing here? And then realizing that this is a player that we might be able to use, and thinking, well, why the hell was he out in Turkey? Do you know what I mean? I can imagine Emery kind of going through that process. You've got at Aston Villa, you've got a player like Bertrand Traoré, who he's admired, and we just loaned him out to the Turkish Super League.
You might also say, dare I say, to sell Anwar El Ghazi for £3 million when he had a year left on his deal. I mean, again, I know people have feelings towards Anwar, but the numbers are beyond dispute. Certainly, I wouldn't mind at this moment in time having Anwar around to boost out the squad, because he can play a role, and certainly in an Emery team, I think he could have perhaps been quite effective. But these are the kind of choices that our previous manager made. We also now are blowing, unfortunately, this is probably a slightly separate issue, but it's irking me, Andy. This is a little bit of spreadsheet manager, but I look at three of our highest paid players, and they are Diego Carlos, Luca Dean, and Philip Coutinho. Diego Carlos obviously is an injury problem, so this isn't anyone's fault, but it's still, you know, we still have to pay him the money. So we're paying something in the region of £450,000 a week on players that aren't troubling the starting 11, and that's not something that Villa can afford to do, and that's based upon the previous manager's kind of magpie-like, which is a little, there you go, segue for Newcastle, magpie-like attraction to shiny things. And that is a real issue, maybe thinking about the summer and also thinking about squad harmony, is how can you have three of your top paid players? And again, let's maybe remove Diego Carlos because that's maybe slightly unfair because again, it is an injury problem, but let's just take Dean and Coutinho. How can we be blowing 300 grand a week on players who aren't necessarily starters, even when fit? And when they are starting, are not necessarily that effective for Aston Villa. So, but those are the kind of choices that were made. El Ghazi out for 3 million, Trezeguet out, fair enough. Sorry, Dan. Traore out on loan, which are boggle the mind. Also, the choice to keep Cameron Archer here and not give him so much of as a biscuit. Of a biscuit's worth of minutes in the Premier League. Lots of very puzzling decisions on the previous incumbent. And now we begin to feel the bite of some of those choices as we get to the business end of the season, not least all the points we lost in the beginning of the season, thanks to that person.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it feels like, it almost feels like we need to, whatever the case, we need to get through this season and kind of get that out of our system for good, that damage, really, don't we? That Gerrard did to the squad, but at least we are in a situation where Emery was able to rectify one of those mistakes and bring Traore back with great effect so far. And another huge benefit of having Emery back, having Emery at the club. We talk about him every week, but it's Ollie Watkins. He is fast becoming a real sort of star in the Premier League. And it looked for a long time like he wasn't going to continue this run of goal scoring form this week. But then a great goal in injury time. Nice move between first Traore and then between Watkins and Ramsey in the penalty area. Back to Watkins, lovely little drop of the shoulder to send the defender for a tea cake, as you might say, Craig. And then a lovely little dink over Navas to make it 2-0. We say it every week, but I'm kind of convinced Watkins doesn't finish this chance a year or so ago, or at least not so clinically or confidently. He was clearly delighted to keep his run going, and it put the team as well into a positive goal difference in the league, which is always a nice thing. And now Ollie's up to 12 for the season. Emery was asked, wasn't he, about whether he'll still need another striker in the summer. And he was fairly non-committal. But do you think this form will change the thinking around the summer business now?
I think it has to. Yeah, I think that we were all, you know, kind of gearing and primed for us splashing a big amount of cash on a centre forward that could take us to the next level. Like Isaac at Newcastle, for example, who's a £60 million player and is doing very well. And, you know, that kind of profile of striker that we can attract to the Premier League in the 50 or 60 million. Obviously, the rumours and the noises around Tammy Abraham won't go away, and that's the kind of price that he would be at. You imagine 40 to 50 million kind of bracket, and that was what we were all thinking was going to happen. But now, with Watkins proving week on week that perhaps he is the man to fire us into the European places, and that he does have everything that we needed. The only thing that was missing from Watkins' game, as we know, was the finishing. And now he seems to have found the magic formula for that. He is, in this form, impossible for Villa to upgrade on. Because the only way you upgrade on him is if you sign Mbappe or Haaland. And we can't sign Mbappe and Haaland. So for Aston Villa, as a club in the let's say mid-table to top six kind of reckoning at the moment. We're going to finish probably somewhere between 6th and 10th, I would think, at the end of the season. For a club with that kind of stature, we cannot attract better than Ollie Watkins. He is now basically as good as it gets.
And that's the thing, isn't it? And that's the thing perhaps we've been missing, the point maybe we were missing before when we were talking about upgrading Ollie Watkins, like it was just the thing you went out and did, and we perhaps tried to do that, didn't we? By getting Danny Ings, and that didn't work out. He proved that he wasn't ever really on Watkins' level. Certainly Gerrard and Dean Smith didn't pick him ahead of Watkins. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think we'll have to wait and see. But what about that point, Craig? On the goal that he scored and a number of the goals he scored. Do you think he has kind of this is the fruit of all that work he's done? He just looks so much more confident and lethal in front of goal.
Yeah, I think you have to say that it is. I think that we saw Ollie Watkins, that the videos in pre-season, the beginning of the season, of him doing extra work, and we were, you know, we somewhat scoffed at it a little bit in the earlier days of the season when he was missing some seriously easy chances, to think, oh, what a waste of time kind of thing. But actually, the extra work and also the extra confidence and the belief put in him by Unai Emery, and also Unai Emery being really clear about what he wants, not only what he wants Ollie Watkins to do, but almost more importantly, what he doesn't want Watkins to do. He doesn't want him getting involved in scraps all over the field. He doesn't want him running the channels, and he doesn't want him working back in the same way. He wants him as a killer between the sticks. So all the credit really has to go to Ollie Watkins, because he's done the work. I've said before that it was going to be up to him if he wants to move to that next level, and he is now moving to that next level. But the key to moving to the next level permanently is consistency, is sustaining it. We've seen many, many people score goals in gluts and bits and pieces like that. Can he now sustain, obviously not these numbers because they're ridiculous, but can he become a 1-in-2 striker in the Premier League for Aston Villa? And can he look towards hitting that 20-goal a season mark and really establish himself as one of the elite players of Aston Villa's Premier League history? Because he's already scored double figures in the Premier League for 3 seasons in a row. Not too many strikers have done that. If he stays, you back him to do it again next year. But can he push on to that next level? Because he's done, I think, 14 Premier League goals in his first season, 12 Premier League goals last season, currently on 12 again. So you back him to beat the 14 perhaps from 2 years ago. But can he push himself towards 19, 20, 21, 22 and really establish himself at the top? That would be a beautiful thing to see. And I think if he carries on like this, the sky's the limit for Ollie Watkins, because he has all the ingredients. And most importantly, he has the attitude and work ethic.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think, because we kind of touched on this before, but he the next thing is kind of almost scoring more than one a game. I know it's harsh. It sounds harsh to say, doesn't it? Obviously, if he was going to reach 20 goals this season, he's probably going to have to have a couple of games where he scores two or maybe three. But do you think that he's got that as well? I mean, he tends to just score the one, doesn't he? Which is great, and we wouldn't be anywhere near where we are without that. But do you think he can go on and be that kind of lethal, where you'd back him to get a couple in a game?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I think that he hasn't really had an opportunity. Certainly not in the Nottingham Forest game. I mean, the first chance in the first half was a half chance at best. But for sure, I think certainly if Villa are continuing to create the chances with the confidence that he's in and the level that he's in at this moment, then he will continue to bang them away. I don't see any reason why he can't score two and three. He's done it before. He scored a famous hat-trick against Liverpool. One of the only, you know, one of the very select few Aston Villa players to have actually scored a hat-trick in the Premier League, a list which also includes Luke Moore, believe it or not. But anyway, it's really up to him to continue the work that he's doing. And I think that, again, with a couple more chances for him and some bigger games where teams unlike Nottingham Forest will come at us. I think Newcastle will come at us a little bit stronger. Certainly the likes of Liverpool will come at us a little bit stronger. We know Brentford are going to attack us when we're away to them. So there's going to be perhaps some more space for Ollie Watkins in some of the games coming up. So that could be, you know, even better for him, because we've seen in recent weeks he scored a couple of his goals on the break where there was space against Chelsea. Lots of space there for that goal where he's lofted it over Kepa's head. Lots of space for the Leicester goal where he's ran in behind again. So you would think with the increased opposition, increased quality of the opposition, should I say, that might actually give Ollie Watkins the opportunity to have more chances to score because there'll be more space for him to work in.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned there about the teams as well. I think when you score goals in high-profile games, isn't it? So obviously Newcastle very much going for the Champions League, probably nailed on for that really now. We're going to be playing Man United. We're going to be playing Tottenham, who are also in that position. These will be high-profile games. It will catch the attention even more, won't it, of obviously the media, but also Gareth Southgate. You know, if he's looking to get in that England squad for the summer matches as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's going to be really interesting and really fun to see what happens with this version of Ollie Watkins if he does get into the England squad. Because this version of Ollie Watkins is a different version to the guy that was there before. And this is someone who could really turn a few heads in terms of Gareth Southgate and his coaching team. So let's see. Certainly, if he carries on scoring goals like he is, he's going to be impossible to leave out. And we know at the end of season internationals, there tends to be players with niggles who drop out and don't necessarily go. So it's going to be good to see, and we'll see. But I think that Watkins, this version of Watkins, can be something quite special for Villa and England.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and he'll be coming up against those England rivals, if you like. Callum Wilson, obviously, next week, and Harry Kane and Ivan Toney over the next few weeks as well. So, you know, we'll see how he compares in those games. But Villa are, as we say, Villa up to the heady heights of sixth in the Premier League now. 8 games to play, 47 points, 6 behind Spurs, who are in fifth. Brighton are obviously just a point below with 2 games in hand, and Liverpool also have a game in hand, and obviously we know the quality that they have on any given day, and both of those teams of course still have to face Villa as well, but it's been a really kind of crazy week going up from the eternal purgatory of 11th, where we seem to be for forever, up 5 places in that week into the European places after picking up the maximum points in those 3 games. Still a long way to go, but how do you kind of process that last week? It's not something we're particularly used to, is it, at Villa, winning 3 games in a week like that? And, you know, how does Emery now keep these players grounded and focused to kind of go on and finish the job?
Well, it's been absolutely magical, hasn't it? I have probably, and probably lots of people listening have done the same. I think I must have consumed every piece of Aston Villa media known to man. My wife, I think, might be thinking I'm having an affair. She keeps asking me what I'm doing on my phone. I'm just reading about Aston Villa, watching about Aston Villa. There's nothing untoward. I just can't get enough. I want to hear all the interviews. I want to hear all of what Unai has to say. I know what Watkins has done some interviews, Mings has, McGinn, and I'm just really trying to absorb all of it because it's so enjoyable. I mean, we've had so many years and months of doom and gloom and awfulness, and for us to be actually now fighting for triumph rather than fighting for survival, I just want to drink it in and absorb every bit of it. I think the players are the same. I think that McGinn's interview, speaking of consuming the media, McGinn's recent interview where he was quite clear about the players keeping out their feet on the ground. They do understand that they just have to keep working, and they do understand that this is a remarkable run of form and will be difficult to maintain. But I think McGinn, to paraphrase McGinn's own words, momentum is key. And I think that the man who sets the tempo is the boss. You do not see Unai Emery getting carried away with a thing. He is business as usual and absolutely unrelenting. There's an inevitability about Unai Emery and his kind of structure and his determination to win. And that kind of steely-eyed focus is kind of permeating through the team. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to win every game. Obviously, you know, we could, but there will probably be defeats for Aston Villa between now and the end of the season. But you know that the structures are in place. You know that we're not fluking our way to victories. You know that the victories are earned and deserved. And you also know that if we do suffer a defeat or get a setback, like the draw away against West Ham, for example, that we're going to be right back at it in that next game, trying to recover and push forward. So I think it's really a time to celebrate. I think it's really great that we know that we're guaranteed. I'm still in the 40-point place. Like, I'm still like, we're definitely in the league next year. This is great. So I'm still kind of luxuriating in that joy. And so this stuff is kind of a bit of a bonus. But I think that there's no chance of people getting complacent or carried away on Unai's watch, because he's just so serious and he's so dead-eyed. And he is, above all else, a winner, Andy.
Yeah, I think this was... obviously, we'd all expressed some doubts about some of the culture within the squad and some of the negative attributes, perhaps. And, you know, obviously, that there was, prior to this 7-game run, we'd lost the 3 games and we'd conceded 11 goals, and it all felt a little bit like it was on the slide again. But we've obviously, you know, they've gone to work. They've picked things up. They've learned from their errors, and they've put together a really, really good run, which has now catapulted them up the league. And it's just that, I suppose, you always have that nagging doubt, don't you? Are the bad habits going to creep in? Are they going to suddenly kind of start believing their own hype? I suppose to some degree they have to, because that breeds confidence. But then, could that be a bad thing as well? But the one thing I've noticed from watching the team over the last few weeks is just the concentration levels. They don't switch off. They're just, you know, they're on it the whole game. They're constantly thinking and working through the game plan, you know, and going through clearly what's been set out for them. And obviously, Unai's there on the touchline guiding them through it. He's very vocal, isn't he? But it's it's great to see.
And I think the Chelsea game was reminiscent of that. I've never seen a Villa team so calm in possession. We were under the pump in that game, make no mistake about it. We were under the gun. But there were so many times where you were expecting the defender just to lash it down the pitch as far as they could, and just kind of try and get 30 seconds of breath in their lungs before the onslaught returns. But this Villa outfit was calm, composed. They're looking for a pass. When they're heading the ball clear, they're trying to head it to a teammate. When they're not just smashing the ball out into row Z and praying for the best, they're trying to find a nuanced, delicate pass. And even under that pressure of a really, really desperate Chelsea side, a really desperate manager clinging on to his job, a really expectant and angry Stamford Bridge packed to the rafters, that kind of character is really going to stand us in good stead, because we still have to go to Anfield, and Liverpool are fighting for their lives in terms of qualifying for Europe. We still got to go to Old Trafford. Man United are fighting for their lives in terms of trying to make sure they qualify for the Champions League. And we still have to host Tottenham and Newcastle and go to Brentford as well. So we're going to need that kind of calm. We're going to need that kind of attitude, and we're going to need that focus moving into these fixtures, because, as you say, there's a lot to play for, and we want to make sure that we do not waste this opportunities. Opportunities to finish in the European places are not a gimme. they are not to be taken for granted and they're not to be sniffed at. I know we covered that in last week's show, but just to reiterate that here, if you can get Europe this season, I don't care if it's Conference, Europa League proper or Champions League, you snatch that opportunity off with both hands and run away with it because you don't know when that's coming again.
Well, I totally agree with that. And, you know, you made that point really clearly last week as well. And absolutely. You also kind of likened Unai Emery to Arsene Wenger. And it just brings to mind a quote from Paul Merson when he was asked about Arsene Wenger at the time when he was a player at Arsenal. And Arsene Wenger came in and he used the term, he said he gives us unbelievable belief. And it was a funny sort of turn of phrase, but it feels like it's quite apt with Unai Emery and this Villa team as well. It feels like the players have that belief. That's why they're not lashing it down the field, like you say, and trying to kind of run the clock down in that way. They feel they've got the belief in their own ability and the belief in the game plan to execute it properly and to hold on to the ball and to be calm in possession and to find their passes. And, you know, it just shows. It's really great to see. I keep looking at the table every day, Craig, just checking that we're still there.
It's great, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. The first time, obviously, we've been in this kind of position since Martin O'Neill was in charge, which is, you know, we're talking 2010, awfully long time ago. And it's just really exciting to feel like that little pipe dream we had a few weeks ago. I think Dan called it. He went early and said, I think we're going to qualify for the Conference League. And it actually feels like an actual possibility now. Even though, like, there are teams with games in hand and things like that, we're in the position, we're in sixth, it's ours to kind of lose in some ways, isn't it? So do you think we're gonna do it, Craig?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's gonna be setbacks, actually, and I think that the fixture against Newcastle could be one of them, because Newcastle are really flying and we are, again, to re-quote Harry Redknapp, we are down to the bare bones here. So I think Newcastle's going to be a really tricky game. But I also think we're going to pick up wins that people aren't expecting us to pick up. I wouldn't be surprised if we picked up some points in the games away at Old Trafford and Anfield. I'm not saying we're going to win both games, but I think there will be points for Aston Villa in those games. I think Tottenham at home is certainly a winnable one. Brentford away is tricky. So I think there's going to be setbacks. We're going to lose, I think, another two. I think we'll lose another two or three games and draw one. But I think we're going to win another four or five. How many games have we got left? Eight. Yeah, I think we're going to get another. I'm expecting us to get another 11, 12 points, Andy, in our remaining fixtures at least. And I think, looking at the league table here, another 12 points puts us on 59. And that does it. That gets us European football. I don't know which European football, but it gets us European football, I think, pretty much guaranteed there.
Yeah.
For that kind of points haul.
Yeah, I feel like that's about the points total, isn't it? And, you know, certainly in that sort of sixth or seventh position. Whether it goes down to eighth, I don't know. I think there is a permutation which can take it down to eighth for the Conference League, but it's intriguing and exciting, and it's great to be suddenly out of nowhere, a little bit like the Championship season, the promotion season, out of nowhere we've suddenly got something to play for. And it's a fantastic thing, and they absolutely deserve all the credit in the world for putting us in this position.
They do, and there are lots of similarities to that promotion run. The dancing at the end of the games, the little chants, and the kind of cult heroes that emerged during that 10 game winning run. You go back to the the kind of Courtney Horse stuff when he was being celebrated, Axel Twanzebe with his little tune that was, he was being celebrated. You know, little Glenn Whelan in there, and Conor Hourihan, and all the great characters that we had. And we've got those kind of characters emerging here. We've got little heroes all over the pitch emerging everywhere. Unlikely heroes like Birch and Traore. Unlikely heroes like Alex Moreno, who's kind of come in as a little-known player from La Liga, who most of the fan base, if they're being honest with themselves, were not intimately familiar with. And he's this turned into this barnstorming, flying left-back slash winger almost. So we've got these little narratives. Ollie Watkins, after 3 years, turning into some kind of elite finishing machine. So we've got all these little narratives all over the pitch, and all these little these wonderful kind of tidbits. And it's like this team has been sprinkled with just a little bit of stardust or something magical. And I think it starts with Emi Martinez at the back, whose story is just incredible, and his story to be world champion and crown the best goalkeeper in the world. We know about Tyrone Mings' story from Chippenham Town, mortgage advisor. There's all these kind of narratives throughout the team here, and it's really like quite a wonderful thing to have these players doing these great things for Aston Villa, because you almost feel like these guys deserve it. I mean, we have had some quite horrible players at Aston Villa over the years who are really unlikable. But I quite like these lads. I don't know about you, Andy. I quite enjoy them.
Well, you know, I've had my thoughts about them, yeah. About some of them. But yeah, I think this is it. And I think it just shows, doesn't it, that, I mean, you said last week, you know, you will think long and hard about writing off an Aston Villa player in future. And I think we all need to do that, because quite often, so often, it's about what's happening behind the scenes, isn't it? These are all good players. There's no question about that. How good they can actually be quite often depends on you know, the coaching and the direction and the leadership they receive and the situation they're in. So, you know, it's we often see it, don't we? You know, great players at one club go to another club and fall apart, and that's you know, that's quite a common story in football. So it just shows there's more to it than just the ability and even the effort. You know, I'm sure they all work hard, and you know, they're certainly putting the hours in. You know, in the video room and on the training field, I think at Bodymore Heath at the moment. So it's fantastic, isn't it? It's just it's another great time to be an Aston Villa fan, and we just hope that we get what we I mean, would it be a massive disappointment? Because it's very unexpected, isn't it? If we didn't get the European place, is it a massive disappointment?
Not a massive disappointment. A massive disappointment would have been for us to keep the other guy in charge and get relegated to the Championship. That would have been a massive disappointment. I don't think I'd be upset. I think it would feel like a bit of a shame, because we've worked so hard to get ourselves in this position. But also, I wouldn't feel like it was terminal to the project. I would think actually it would almost galvanize us to be like, okay, we know what we're capable of now, with a proper start next season without the obvious problems we had before November, we will be in a much better position to qualify. We do still need to be almost perfect to qualify for Europe, and that is a tough ask, particularly when we have some really tough games coming up and a squad that is kind of starting to creak now under the strain. So with that kind of context, you could understand us having a slip and a fall and a blip here or there between now and the end of the season. So it wouldn't be like it was criminal for Villa to let it slip from here. But I would also say that I don't think that's going to happen. I'm with Dan, man. I believe. I think we're in Europe next season. I've got my. I mean, I don't live in Europe anymore. But if I did, I guess nor do you either, Andy. I would.
That wasn't my choice.
Yeah. Well, we have a we'll have the old passports dusted off and are ready to go. An away day in the Czech Republic or Latvia. You know, let's go for it, man. I think we're going to be there. I believe, Andy. I believe.
I suppose it's whether we're allowed in, isn't it? But yeah, no, thanks for bringing that up, though. one team who definitely will be in Europe next season are Newcastle, and they're our next opponents. Saturday lunchtime, they've recovered a little bit from a slight slump and foot in form a few weeks ago, and now firm favourites to get one of the Champions League spots under their manager Eddie Howe. They were on the back of victories against Man United, which was very impressive, and Brentford last weekend, and have two in-form strikers in Callum Wilson and Isak. The last time, of course, out against Newcastle at St James's Park, a managerless Villa at the time lost 4-0 as we awaited for Unai Emery's arrival. And Newcastle are so good that even Matt Target can't quite get a place in the team at the moment, Craig. So they Who? Must be. They must be absolutely flying. Villa will likely be without Bailey, as we talked about earlier, with the fitness of Matt Cash, Coutinho and Kamara, all a bit touch and go at the moment. This feels like a huge match in terms of determining our progress. How do you see this one going, and can Emery pull off another big result, or is it a test too far?
I Newcastle are flying. They've won 5 and 5. They've just really given West Ham an absolute pasting. They went away to Brentford and won, which is no mean feat either. Isak and Wilson are beginning to form a really formidable partnership, and also Newcastle just don't concede a lot of goals. So it is going to be very, very tough. And let's not forget, they smashed us 4-0 earlier in the season, and it could have been 7 or 8, and that would not have flattered Newcastle in the very brief Aaron Danks era. So we have to treat them with the respect they deserve. I know there's a lot of I don't know, manufactured rivalry between Villa and Newcastle fans, I think, which stretches back to the Sub on the Time banner. I think over 10 years ago, we were buddies in the championship for a little while, as Rafa Benitez's team romped to the title, and we languished in 13th place under Brucey and Di Matteo, respectively. So there is a little bit of needle there, I guess, amongst the fan base, and also there is the simple fact that Newcastle completely leapfrogged us. When Target went to Newcastle, it was again a little bit of scoff and chortle, chortle, chortle from Villa fans, because it looked like he was going to be in the championship in a few months because Newcastle were down the bottom. Eddie Howe went in and took over from Steve Bruce, who might be the best person in football to take over from because he's so bad, and turned them around, and they ended up finishing comfortably in mid-table while we faltered and splattered and spluttered our way to, I think, 13th under the previous incumbent. So Newcastle have leapfrogged us here. There's no question. And they are in the prime box seat here for Champions League football. They are outside of Manchester City and Arsenal, they're the best team in the league based on form this season. That's just the facts. So this will be very, very difficult, very, very challenging. And given our threadbare squad, it's going to be a really, really difficult ask. But we're flying, we're at home, the Villa fans are on side. We could hopefully be buoyed by a return of maybe Kamara, maybe Coutinho. Obviously, we're recording this on Monday, so we don't know the team news yet for the Saturday fixture. But there's certainly time for the players who have been struggling from the 3 games in a week to recover. There's certainly time for hopefully Kamara to come back, or Coutinho, maybe even Cash has an outside chance of being involved. So we could be boosted by those returns. And even if we're not, I think we have enough we certainly have enough in the team and in the squad to be competitive and maybe even sneak a win, but probably leaning towards a draw for this one. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, really, because I think we're so used to looking at the form of other teams, aren't we? And judging it by that. And obviously Newcastle appear very frightening. you know, obviously on that amazing run. I'd forgotten about the 5-1 at West Ham, which I think David Moyes neglected to mention as well in his post-match interview on Saturday. He referred to the 2-1 nil wins and completely left out the 5-1 defeat. But, you know, that's natural, I suppose. But I think, you know, when you get a team in that type of form, you kind of worry about it, don't you? But I think you've got to have faith as well, to some degree, in the fact that Villa are extremely well drilled at the moment. We are carrying out match-winning game plans every week. We don't concede many goals either. We've you know, very, very miserly at the back at the moment, and it feels like, whenever we take the field, there is a system, there is a plan, and the players are up for it, and they're executing those plans. So you have to assume, again, you know, like you say, it's good that they've got a week to recover from that tricky week last week, and they can, you know, they can go into Saturday full of confidence, I think, and knowing that if they do, I think what they're asked to do, they'll be with a really good chance of getting something from the game. I mean, I would, at this point, take your arm off for a draw. But I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be massively, I'd be over the moon, but I wouldn't be massively surprised if we did a bit of a number on them and, you know, contain them, contain their threats and beat them. That's
there you go.
So it feels like a stretch. I think we will be second favourites going into it, and the fact we're at home, I think I'd feel more confident if it was at St James's Park. But I do fancy us, and I think maybe the early kickoff will help us as well. Possibly, we'll just see. But I'm confident that it'll be a draw or a win. I'm going to stick my neck out.
Well, yeah, let's put it that way. Newcastle are due a defeat. They haven't lost since March the 4th, which was away against Man City. Then they lost the cup final the week before that. They lost to Liverpool the week before that. And then they drew with Brentford on February 11th. So they're not perfect. They have lost games of football. They will lose more games of football between the end of now and the end of the season. And why can't they lose to us? I say they can, Andy. I'm with you. You've changed my mind.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I feel like Brentford were quite unfortunate not to get something last Saturday. They certainly had the better of the first half, missed a penalty. I think had a goal disallowed. So, you know, Newcastle came back strong in the second half, but, you know, Brentford was certainly on top. And, you know, I do think Newcastle, although they're more than the sum of their parts still. I don't think they've got a really good striker in Isak, but I still regard them a little bit like Villa in that respect, that it's the coaching and the manager that are kind of put them in the position they're in. So I think it's all to play for on Saturday. And do you want to bet against us?
No.
No. So, but what do you think, prediction-wise? You're going to give us a prediction?
2-1, Villa.
2-1. 2-1,
you've
Villa.
Changed my, I was going to go 1-1, but you've taught me into it.
Oh, you see, I was going to go 2-1.
Well, you go 2-1, I'll go 1-0. There you go.
Okay, yeah. No, I think 2-1. I think we will concede, but I've just got a feeling that we'll do enough of a job on them, and maybe their nerves will get to them a little bit more than they will to us, hopefully. But we shall see. We shall see. But that's all we got time for today. Craig, thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to you for joining me this week. Really good to keep the run going and keep the positivity going on this incredible turn of events for Aston Villa. But thanks for listening, everyone. please head over to the website undergaslitlamp.com, and also give us a follow on all the socials, Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, and put your notifications on for the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll let you know when the podcasts are available. But thanks to everyone for their support. If you're going to the game on Saturday, have a great afternoon. And we'll be back next week to review that and look ahead to the next match. Until then, stay safe and up the Villa.